This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Hey everyone. I'm 27 hours in. I was 27 hours ago, I was 3 hours south of Bangkok. So I've just rushed and got a shower, which has made me feel a lot better and will be much better for you guys in the front row too. Believe it or not, I speak about 150 times a year around the world to various kind of places. And it would be absolutely ludicrous to think I was an expert on 150 topics. I'm certainly not an expert on youth justice, but I care about it passionately. The most important speech I'll give this year is today. The one I've looked forward to the most is today. The one I care about most is today. So I'm here not speaking in any capacity, really, except as a Lancasterian. I was born in Lancaster, went to Lancaster Royal Grammar School, was expelled unjustly. Where was youth justice when I needed it? And tomorrow I'll be going back up to school since I'm now on the Board of Governors. That's justice, right? So now the headmaster reports to me. It is a wonderful, wonderful world. I live in New Zealand and New York, and I have a home in Grasmere, the most beautiful village in the world. I've been to Southport many times, obviously when I was a kid growing up, and I played a lot of cricket here. When I used to come to Southport, I think it was very posh and very fancy, and I still got the same impression when I came in today. It just looks sort of Victorian, very elegant, and very. Very, very nice. I had to cover up the shirt that I was wearing in case the locals took offense. So I was kicked out of school. I was a captain of rugby and I was captain of cricket, and I was an alpha student and all that. And I fell in love at the age of 17 with the head girl of Lancaster Girls Grammar School. And she became pregnant. Actually, when you put it that way, it sounds sort of innocent, doesn't it? I never thought of it like that. Maybe I should have used that. She became pregnant. And actually, it was only the second time we'd done it as well. So I didn't really have a clue. I came from a Catholic family, although I'm not Catholic. But my parents were both Catholic. I became Protestant as soon as I could. And at school, you know, we spent all our time in biology cutting up frogs and stuff. And didn't. Yeah, so did you, right? I never got that. I've never cut up a frog. I am very adept, however. I mean, I understand everything about it, but I've never done. Anyway, so we didn't know anything about it. Anyway, the point is, so the headmaster of the school was a Southerner at the time, right? The first Southerner we'd ever had. And John Lorraine Spencer, never forget him, right? He's unfortunately died. And I say unfortunately because I cannot wreak my revenge on him now. But he's no longer with us. And he took the view that if Barbara had the baby and I stayed with her, I would have to leave the school. And that I should do the sensible thing as I was storming through 4 A-levels and all this kind of stuff at the time and was captaining all the sports teams. I should do the sensible thing and just put this thing off to one side and deal with it 3 or 4 years later, which I didn't really think was justice for her or for me or for the baby. So it all came to a sad end. And the worst thing that happened to me at that time was I came from a very poor family. My father was a security guard in a mental hospital, the Royal Albert Hospital, which is actually not too dissimilar for the job I have today. It's kind of the same thing. And my mother worked in a shop selling greetings cards, right? They both left school when they were 14. They were of that generation. And so it was it was just a sort of disturbing time because it was very clear what my life looked like, right? I was going to go to grammar school, fantastic, do really well, go to university, and then do whatever you do right, when you come out of university. I don't know what all that was. And then all of a sudden, the only thing I possessed at that time was my first team rugby jersey. I had no other possessions. I lived in a council house. I used to live in a prefab, so a council house was an upgrade. And the headmaster publicly, in front of the whole school, took my jersey off me. Justice really It's something I care a lot about, and I didn't think I was getting a lot. As it happened, anyway, this story has a really happy ending. Otherwise, I wouldn't depress you on a Thursday afternoon, because about 7 years ago, the new headmaster of the school said, gee, we haven't had too many people from Lancaster Royal Grammar School who have become sort of publicly known. Cecil Parkinson was the first. You were the second. We had a lot in common. Anyway, it must be something in the water in Lancaster or whatever. And he said, I want you to come back, and yada, 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 yada. And I went back, and I went up to the school, and Lancaster Grammar were playing Bradford Grammar School, which is a funny little town over in Yorkshire somewhere. And traditional rivalries, as you would know. And the guys asked me if I would. I'm the chairman of USA Rugby, and I was on the board of the All Blacks. So they asked me if I would go into the dressing room before the game and talk to the team, because it was a very big game for the team. And so I talked to the team, blah, 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 blah. And the school won a pretty sort of average game, 9-3. Typical English rugby, a lot of kicking and a lot of not much else, really, but there you go. And at the end of the game, I went back into the shed to congratulate the team, and the first 15 captain stood up and said, you know, it was a great pleasure for them to meet me, blah, blah, blah. Took off his jersey and he gave it to me. Nice. I'm sure that's not what you came here to talk about. Me neither, really, but I was just thinking about being back up north and all that kind of stuff. When I was 14, we came, you know, from a pretty poor background, so we didn't have a lot of food, right? In those days, when you were poor, right? In these days, not much has changed, unfortunately. And there's still lots and lots of poor people around wherever you live, in New Zealand, in the UK, or in the US. And one day I was in a supermarket in Lancaster, and I was stealing some bread. And I'd been doing it for about a year, though. So, and I guess they finally got tired of me nicking the bread, right? So they had the local copper, unbeknownst to me, come in, and yeah, they caught me and all that. And the guy said, what are you doing? You know, you've got a great school thing, you've got a great education. I said, yeah, but we haven't got any money or not much food. And he said, no, I understand that, but you can't nick it. Come with me to the police station. But I was pretty scared, right? 14. I was pretty scared. I thought I was very scared. And he took me down to the police station, and they scared me a little bit more, and then said, there's a local lads club in Lancaster called Lancaster Lads Club. You're a really competitive athlete, and you're really good at inspiring people. This will go no further if you come down to this club now and teach these kids soccer. So I was pretty relieved, and what this guy did then was he helped me turn my life around, right? Away from just school and away from all this. He showed me a compassion. He made me work, but he put me into a situation where I could help others, which is the most inspirational thing for a kid. If you can help someone else, boy, then you feel, you know, twice as big as that. And I never ever forgot that. And in fact, I founded 11 years ago a charitable foundation in New Zealand called Turn Your Life Around, where we save, or we help, lots and lots of at-risk kids who have erred and got into trouble with the law, but with the help of usually their school and the police, not usually their parents. Most of them are single-parent homes anyway, and most of the parents don't care. But with the help of a principal and with a local policeman, these kids embark on our program and try and turn their life around. We've been running this program now for, I guess, 13 years. We founded it in Auckland. We have a 75% success record. 75% of our kids, 14 to 16, never, ever get into trouble with the law again, which is pretty pretty good. It's funded by me, by the government now, and by the police, and it has some very highly active principals involved. My eldest daughter, Rebecca, is now a trustee as well on that whole thing, and it really, really works. And I was excited today at the chance to connect with people like you who are doing all that kind of stuff on a much larger scale here in the UK. And I wanted to share sort of three thoughts, really, that have driven me. So I think we have about 20 minutes or something like that. And um, It starts with a quote from Saul Alinsky, who said, "Last guys don't finish nice." And getting to kids first and early was what saved me. These guys got to me early and fast before I'd had chance to do anything stupid, more stupid than I'd already done. And our challenge, I think, or the challenge we took, well, we've changed the age groups now in Tyler over the last 5 years, unfortunately, and we're now having to work with 10-year-olds and 11-year-olds. You know, in New York, they're working with 7-year-olds. But we're having to work with 10, 11-year-olds now. We started with 14 to 16, and it's just slipped down. Most of the kids we work with come from multi-kid home, you know, 8 kids. 7 of the kids are probably in gangs, you know, making and selling pee and all that kind of stuff. Many of the All Blacks help with Michael Jones, Inzan Brooks, Sean Fitzpatrick help. And every year we have a passing out parade at my house for the kids who've come through. We get through about 200 kids a year, and they get their wings if they qualify. And we have this very most of the kids are not Pākehā. They're not white kids. They're Pacific Islanders or Maori or whatever. Generally Pacific Islanders or Maori. And so there's a lot of cultural and ritual around this sort of passing out. Most of them, parents don't even come. So the kids are doing it on their own, and they're making choices. And the first time we did this, a decade ago, Fitzpatrick was the All Black captain at the time, tough, hard man. He started life as a builder, you know, left school with no education. And he was talking to this little kid who was 13, 14 years old. And he said to this this kid who just passed out, you know, he'd gained his wings. He said to this kid, you know, "What does your dad do?" He's making conversation. He said, "He's a murderer." Fitzy goes, "Do you have any brothers and sisters?" "Oh, yeah, yeah." "What do your brothers do?" I said, "They're murderers." 3 of the family were in jail for murder, and this kid was passing out on his own. So it's pretty hard yakka kind of thing. So our challenge is to get there early and to get there first. In the UK, I know your imprisonment rates continue to rise. We have the same problem in New Zealand. Maori are 14% of the population and 50% of the people who go to jail. There's something terribly wrong in that. In the US, where I spend a lot of time in New York, I actually do some work with prisoners on Rikers Island. It is horrendous. The whole imprisonment setup in the US is out of control. It's out of control. The view that we've taken at Tyler and that I learned when I was 14 is that prevention beats punishment every time. And prevention's where I think we should be investing time, dollars, effort, and I know that many of you are involved in that same thing. The links to poverty, the links to illiteracy, substance abuse, crime, the tremendous impact of cultures like the Samoan and Tongan culture, which are very maternal, so the male side of life do go off the rails, and then you do follow your brothers. All this kind of stuff is pretty challenging. But it is one that I have dedicated my life to, and one that I am absolutely committed to. At Saatchi & Saatchi, we allow all of our people 10% of their time to work pro bono on stuff that engages them and inspires them. And we try to cover a wide gamut and to make sure that pro bono time isn't wasted on stuff like green shrubs or something. We're sort of more involved in our place in sustainability in terms of not just the planet, frankly, but the people who live on that planet. So we encourage our people where we can for them to do things for Habitat for Humanity or for whatever, things where they can personally make a difference. And we confront big issues. I've had lots of warnings today to be very sensitive, because you're obviously such sensitive, blushing flowers and shrinking violets, and I mustn't be too provocative. I certainly must not swear, in case you never go out to a pub or anything, and I should not be politically incorrect. I won't swear. I'll ignore everything else. Now, for those of you that were looking, I'm showing you that not to ruin your Friday night. I'm showing you that because that was made pro bono by Saatchi in New Zealand. And in fact, the guy, the actor in there, was a creative director of ours, whose name, funnily enough, is Andy Blood. We made that free to download. 40% of homes in New Zealand were sent that piece of free videotape by someone, by friends, by parents, by guardians. The calls to Care New Zealand increased by 30% in a month through confronting the issue and through allowing people to share it, because there is nothing more powerful. Who do you believe? Do you believe your best mate, or do you believe the government, or do you believe an ad? So we made that through the wonders of the internet, through the wonders of YouTube, through the wonders of viral, available to everyone to pass on, to really make a difference, and it did. The three ideas I want to share with you today are ideas that really come from... I've run Saatchi & Saatchi for the last 13 years, when the brothers Saatchi, the brothers Grimm, departed for pastures of art galleries and things. And language is my only weapon against the forces of evil and the forces of darkness. Revolution starts with language. I believe the way you frame an issue really matters. I believe the right language takes you and kids into the right territory. If you look at what's happening politically in the UK now, we are bereft of new language. Bereft. The game is being played in the time-honored manner. It doesn't matter whether it's left or right, or whether they're all in the middle, whether it's the same. President Obama won an election through language, through dream, through hope, through change, through creating a movement. His policies and his substance actually are not that flash. In fact, nobody really knew what they were, right? And it didn't really matter, because he reframed the whole question from despair into hope. And 2 years ago, I was invited to the Pentagon. This is not the kind of phone call that you particularly want, okay? And I entered the Pentagon with a couple of very big Marines, okay? Two Marines equal the English rugby union pack, okay? And they don't talk a lot. They're not small talk. I don't think you go to Marines for small talk, right? You walk in, and you get everything, right? They're fingerprinted. They kind of take your toe prints, your fingernails. They take a few blood samples. They take some hair off your head. I used to have hair before that meeting. And then in front of me in this room was a room like this, except it was much more scary, despite all the warnings I had about sensitivity and everything. In front of me was every initial possible, the CIA, the FBI, the NSC. Some initials were too secret, they even couldn't tell me the initials. And they were asking me how we could reframe terrorism, okay? And so I spoke to them for a long time, and I spoke to them about changing the language from the war on terror. I said, war on terror is really bad language because nobody wants to go to, well, you Americans, but apart from you Americans, nobody wants to go to war because wars are bad because people keep getting killed. Do you remember Vietnam? You get killed, okay? So we don't like going to war. We don't like sending our kids to war. We don't like sending our neighbors to war. We don't actually like dying for our country. We'd like the other guys to die for their country, but we don't want to die for our country. We don't like war. It's a bad word. And terror, you just legitimize the whole thing. Terror is a terrifying word. And as soon as you start talking about the war against terror, man, you've already lost and they're already winning. So we told them that they had to change the language to the fight for a better world. Because everybody likes a fight. Because usually in fights you don't die, but you can stand up and be strong and combat shoulder to shoulder with your mate and all that kind of stuff. You can feel better after it, no matter what. And everybody wants a better world. Although I didn't think there were seven virgins waiting for me in my version of the better world. But we all wanted, that's not swearing. We virgins are completely, you know, proper word. And in fact, then Bush started to use it, right? And there was a kind of change about that thing. For me, if you change the language, if you change the conversation, you change a person's world, and you change the way they touch. So Tyler, for me, which is the name that we decided to call my charity in the UK, is about turn your life around, because that's what happened to me, turning your life around. It's about directing personal support for at-risk 10 to 16-year-olds. It's all about early intervention and mentoring. We have one counselor in New Zealand costs us $40,000. Every time I give a speech, I charge $60,000. So every time I give one speech, I get one counselor, and every counselor works with 9 kids. We don't have any infrastructure, any management, or any of like that. We have one CEO and then counselors, and we have a board of trustees who help. We don't have offices. The police give us them. So we have 100% of our funding going against mentoring kids. Full time, okay? So it's very sort of simple. One counselor, social worker, really, 9 kids. Close relationship with police and schools. We had it's prevention, not punishment and responsibility. So I'm not an expert in this. I know you have to punish and all that kind of stuff. I'm sort of more engaged in trying to prevent. We had a lot of people from New York come over and study the program, and they couldn't make it work in New York. And they couldn't make it work because they couldn't get corporate police and schools to work together. They just couldn't make that happen because of politics, because of power, because of all the bad stuff that you're probably very familiar with when you try and get multifunctional task forces, right? Who funds it? Who gets the budget? Who gets the power? You're more expert in that than me. We don't have that problem in New Zealand. It's a small place, and they do what I tell them. Community, it's a community collaborative program. We cannot rely on the parents or the families because they've usually single parent and they've usually just lost control. So we have to get the community involved. It is family-centered and family-involving. It's got long-term engagement with unbroken support. It's great now because 11, 12 years in, a bunch of our social workers are Tyler kids who've graduated with wings. So they've now come back, which is really a great way because the story continues, the legend continues, and so on. And hundreds of young lives have been turned around. We do a couple of hundred a year. I think we need more ideas, more imagination, more experiments around how to head trouble off for kids, around to how, you know, how to set things going and how to get it straight. The framing of the war on terror is one example. New Zealand's family group conference system of justice reframed retribution as repairing the harm. Repairing the harm, which is a lovely concept. It's a very helpful, it's a very inspirational, it's a very forward-thinking concept. It's not punishment-focused. It's not blame-focused. 20 countries, I think, have now adopted that, and 30 U.S. states. So it's getting some traction. The most powerful framework for freedom really is built in the heart. There's a Maori concept which is called mana. And it's really important to kids, mana. It denotes personal bearing, presence, and character. A lot of these kids look for mana by joining gangs and by committing crimes. That's how they get their mana. We've tried to transform that mana, that respect, that desire to be someone, to be seen as being someone, into a positive way. Models of family, mana, responsibility, and accountability. Those are the things that we need to look for. And I think in our society, I think in terms of Britain now, it's very hard to find people who inspire youth with their mana. Very hard, right? Most of the athletes that they look up to are not the kind of athletes necessarily that inspire mana. Most of the entertainers, perhaps not. And I think that's a responsibility for us to try and find those kind of role models that we can bring, to kids. I was in Brussels a few weeks ago having dinner with the top 10 country heads of Toyota, so Toyota GB, Toyota Spain, Toyota Germany, blah, 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 because we handle all Toyota's advertising. And I was asking these guys, you're all marketing wizards and everything like that, you know, and we have to look at the next generation coming up. We've just done some research amongst 14 to 18-year-old boys in urban USA. And you can translate the findings into the UK immediately. And we asked these kids one burning question, which was, how as a peer group would you describe yourselves? We are, in one word, what are we? What are these 14 to 18-year-old kids? How do they see themselves? When I was growing up in the 60s, we all saw ourselves as rebels. Man, we were rebelling against everything. The system, the war, parents, education, government, dress, art, music. We were all sort of rebels, right? We didn't know what it was we wanted, but we knew what it was we didn't want. So how do these, what is the key word that these kids call themselves? Do you want to hazard a guess? Sure you do. Just somebody be brave and yell something. How do they see themselves? We are what? You work with them all the time. Victims. Ah. Okay, victims. Cool. Together? Did you say together? Yeah, good. Victims, cool, together. That's a good gamut. Anybody else? So that's a nice range to play in. We'll start with victims here, cool here, and together here. That's a nice range. Anyone else want to have a crack? Gangsters, warriors. So we go, we'll take that as a positive thing, warriors, slightly. Gangsters is probably not on our scale. Soldiers, young, smart, pushing towards the truth here. Yeah, go on. Fascinating, isn't it? I only know the answer because we studied 10,000 of them. So, interestingly enough, the Toyota guys were like you. There was, and they all had kids, by the way, in this age group, right? Now, they weren't seeing the seamy side of life the way I'm sure you see, okay? These are very privileged executives, okay? But they did run the gamut of, first of all, most of them thinking, I think on the negative side, that they thought these kids would think themselves as gangsters, beyond the law, cynical, stroppy, this kind of aggressive language. There were some who felt that they would be victims, at the end of the chain, no way out, hopeless, da-da-da. There were some people that thought that they would be there. And then there were some people who thought they would be in the connector, collaborative, together area. The kids described themselves overwhelmingly as, we are creative. We are creative. We will make our own lives, be they gangster or warrior. We will be supremely cool because we're creative, because we can. We will create our own atavars. We will create our own bunch of friends. We will create our own social networks. We will create our own films. We will create our own music. We will create our own blogs. We will create our own communication system. We will create our own ecosystem that none of you are remotely allowed into because we are creative and you are sellouts. So kids, what's, and that's 10,000 people, right? It's not, they didn't all say that, but that was the, and many of the words that you used were sort of in the minority thing. But overwhelmingly, these kids believe they're empowered and liberated to create new identities, new behaviors, and we are not tracking there with them, really. Or none of our Toyota guys were. None of the Toyota guys were remotely, and neither would I have been either, so we're remotely near the answer. But isn't that, I found it overwhelmingly optimistic, exciting, positive, stimulating. I would say that, wouldn't I? Because I believe in the unreasonable power of creativity. But if we could harness that creativity, if we could inspire that creativity, if we could imagine that creativity into a world of positive mana rather than negative mana, I think it would be an awesome kind of thing.
1 minute, please. Time, thank you. Could you all please put down your pens and bring your papers to the front of the room? Thank you. Well done. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry, you're too late. Gave you plenty of warnings about time. You failed. Sorry.
Excuse me, do you know who I am?
I have absolutely no idea.
Good.
That's better. So there's only three messages. The first message is I want you, we haven't shared that creative thought with anyone yet. We're going to work a heck of a lot with it now with people like Apple, with people like Sony, with people like Toyota. We've, that's where the whole iTunes things come from. That's where the whole mashes come through on YouTube. That's where we have cars in the US, the Scion, which are just a bare box. And we just say to the kid, there you go, man, design it yourself in the showroom. And it's amazing what they do. So if we can look for that creativity, and if you can harness that creativity, and if you can inspire that creativity, we are hiring these kids all the time, right? The average age of my company is 27 years old. And obviously, I lift that up quite a lot, right? And so the kind of creative kids, if we can turn their lives around and give them positive focus, for me, it's very exciting. The second step is be an inspirational player, right? I don't believe in leadership particularly, and I don't believe in management either, right? I mean, if you think about management, I guess the easiest description to think about management is doing things right, which is better than the alternative. But you're not going to make the world a better place. You're not going to transform the world just by doing that. It's not enough. All the literature sort of changed in the 60s and 70s away from, in those days you had to do total quality systems and 360-degree feedback and every process that you live with every day in your life. There are now no secrets in all those processes. Everybody knows what a balanced scorecard is. Everybody can project manage through Rasky and whatever. If you're not well managed, you're dead, buried, and gone. But if you're beautifully managed, you're competitive, but that's all. Right? So management changed when everybody, when all the secrets sort of went out of it, and it all became, it's all about leadership now. Leadership, right? The leadership secrets of Attila the Hun, right? The leadership secrets of Clive Woodward and other nonsense, right? So the problem with leadership is that whatever model you look at, the servant leader model or the traditional model or whatever, what is the one thing that all leaders need to succeed, irrespective of business, country, market, or whatever? What does every leader need? He needs a bunch. What?
Charisma.
He does need charisma. How am I doing? Followers. You know, it's very hard. Follow me, baby. Which you do charismatically. follow us. Do you all know each other? No. Okay, so this is not particularly politically correct, is it? No. It's on the edge. Okay, so this could be good news or bad news for you, depending where you're sitting, and I haven't chosen where you're sitting. But if you take a look at the person on your left, if there's any Australians in the room, that's like this way. Okay, and so you were looking to your right then. So look to your left. You're looking to your right. Look to your left, this way. And imagine that this person on your left, this is where it can get good or bad, right, has got a tattoo on their buttocks. See, and that's just the luck of the draw, right? Now, it's bad news for you, right? It's bad news for you. Terrible news for you. Great news for you. But it's just the way it goes. And imagine that could you imagine that tattooed on that person's left buttock would be the immortal words, "Born to follow"? I just don't think so, because you're all here because you're not followers. Because there is no way that followers are going to change the business that you're in, which is youth justice. Followers ain't going to do that. This is going to be about inspirational players. So I'm not a believer in management. I'm not a believer in leadership. I'm a believer in inspiration. And I think that's how we all connect. And that's what England needs. And that's why I came here, because I was told that you were a bunch of inspirational players, that you were actually working with the people that make the difference. Is that true? Fantastic. I absolutely know you can find a spark of good in everyone. In everyone. We work for Gordon Brown. So we can find and he's got a lot of good in him. We find a spark of good in everyone. A friend of mine, John Wareham, he's a great guy. He wrote a fantastic book. He's the guy who took me to Rikers. And he wrote a book called How to Break Out of Prison. And obviously it's sort of more metaphorical than the physical, although the boys were quite disappointed, I think. So do you guys know who Mark Brandon Reed is? Chopper Reed. Yes? He's an Australian. What do you know about him? Violent, psycho, mass murderer. Cut his ear off. He wasn't the painter bloke. So he killed 26 people, all other criminals. The Australians let him out. I come from New Zealand. You know the difference between Australia and New Zealand, right? Right? We actually chose to go to live there. So, in fact, if you go to Australia today with your English passport, the very first question they ask you when you rock up to immigration is, do you have a criminal record? It's obviously still a requirement. Anyway, Australia let Chopper Reed out. And Saatchi & Saatchi being Saatchi & Saatchi, we used him in a couple of ads.
A lot of you people might be very upset that I'm doing this commercial, but I'm advertising something I know a great deal about, and that's killing. I've shot people, I've baseball batted them to death, I've iron barred them to death, I've stabbed them to death. I've set fire to them. If you get into a car and you've been drinking too much and you kill somebody, then you're no different than me. That's all it is. You're a murdering maggot.
When I was in prison, I got slashed in the face. My ears cut off. I had a claw hammer put from my brain just here. Cutthroat razors. Here. Here. 8.5-inch butcher's knife. There. Ice pick. There. Ice pick up the back there. If you drink and you drive and you're unfortunate enough to hit somebody, you want to pray to God you don't ever go to prison.
Within 3 months of airing that campaign, obviously I was hauled onto every TV show in Australia and tortured by the Liberals and all these people. We, of course, did not pay him for the commercials and all that, but I was still grilled, okay, up and down. And of course, what happened is we had a tiny budget for that campaign, and all the free publicity we got, because every station ran it, it was an amazing thing. Within 6 months, deaths from drunk driving had halved. Halved. Think of all the campaigns, all the money had halved because of the amount of stuff. Halfway through the first day when this ran, which is pretty controversial in Australia, I was exhausted. I'd done about 9 TV shows and lots of interviews, and my mobile rang. It's Chopper Reed's lawyer. This is like getting the call from the Pentagon. You don't want the guy to have your number. You don't want him on the phone. I said, what? Actually, I said, no, what? He said, you've got to pull the ad, the first ad that you saw. I said, mate, we've been talking about this for 6 months. It's everything's happening the way we wanted it to happen. We're getting free publicity everywhere. Now you've got to pull it. Why? He's never admitted the baseball batting before. That's a true story. Inspiration underpins my core beliefs, right? The things that drive me are I believe that nothing is impossible. I believe that the role of business is to make the world a better place for everyone, which is why I'm here today. I believe that inspirational players like you can change the world. I don't believe governments can. I don't believe politics can. I don't believe policies can. I believe they're enablers. I believe they help. I believe they create a framework. But we have to change these kids and save these kids one kid at a time, one choice at a time, one piece of emotional heartbreak at a time. And the people that do that are in the front line. The people that do that are you. Inspirational players can change the world because inspiration unleashes potential. Inspiration's emotional, it's contagious, and it's about action, and it delivers real results. You know, you can think about rational and emotional. 80% of decisions are emotional. 80% of decisions are emotional. The difference between rational and emotional thinking, we've studied all this, is that rational thinking leads to conclusions and or policy statements. Emotion leads to action. And every one of you is in the action business. You're here to deliver justice and to turn kids' lives around. That's an action calling. Emotions at the heart of what you do. You must be drained every night. You must pump yourself up every morning to get out into these front lines, because I know they're pretty tough. But I believe there's good in all of us.
I've 10 fingers, 10 toes, 2 eyes, 2 knees, 1,000 of you. Do you know what the world only is one of me? Yeah.
75 takes. And at the end of it, that kid was so, because he'd done 75 too. That's why he went at the end. Yeah, because he knew he'd got it right. It was the funniest. All right, man. Yeah, the world's only got one of us. One. Daniel Dennett said it was an occupational hazard to be asked the meaning of life. You know, he was a philosopher, so he was constantly asked, what's the meaning of life? So he decided that he had an answer. And the answer is, the secret of happiness is to find something bigger than yourself and devote your life to it. And I don't think it can be anything bigger than youth justice, because our whole future relies upon our youth and getting that right, and we are wasting generation after generation, and that's just not good enough. So I'm really impressed and humbled by the work you do. And in my view, you can inspire. We asked the kids at Tyler 3 questions, and we put them to work on this over a 12-month period. The first question is, we asked them to define their 5-year dream and define it however they want, in pictures, in words, in a song, in a video, in a piece of prose. But what does their 5-year dream is? Because they don't realize they have the right to dream. They've stopped dreaming. They've had it knocked out of them. They don't believe in dreams anymore. They've been just subjugated to defensiveness and cynicism for so long. So we encourage them to dream. And it's amazing some of the things that they start very small, obviously. And then it's amazing what they can come with. The second question we ask them is, when am I at my best? Because these kids have got no self-esteem left, right? And they're looking to gain self-esteem through sometimes really really bad ways. So we try and work with them to find situations when they're at their best. Because all kids are better in some areas and some fields than in others. Find those, and we then tailor the work so that the kids spend more time. We don't do a lot of correcting weaknesses. We do a lot of building on strengths and trying to give kids confidence, self-esteem, and belief. The third question is, what will I never do? Where we try and get them, you know, they're never going to go to jail. They're never going to take drugs. They're never going to steal anything. They're never going to hit someone weaker than them, whatever. We try and get them to commit to those three questions. And they work with these three questions for about, some of them have been working them now for 10 years, and they're still talking to us about them. So it's simple, but it does set young hearts on fire.
Well, I think it's fine building jumbo planes, taking a ride on a cosmic train. Switch on summer from a slot machine. Just get what you want to if you want, as you can get anything. I know we've come a long way, we're changing day to day. But tell me, where do the children play? I know we've come a long way, we're changing day to day. But tell me, where do the children play?
Third and final idea is fight on. Dreams are where you start, right? Martin Luther King did not say, I have a mission statement. With a mission statement, JFK would never have put a man on the moon, so you might answer the same three questions for yourselves. Wouldn't be the worst place to start. I've seen wonderful things when people have the guts to live their dream. And there are a few problems, in fact I've not seen any, that can't be solved if enough people commit themselves to a dream. We're very involved in sustainability, and we have a program. We want to be the first true blue agency, and it's called DOT. Just do one thing. You know, you can't change the world by the big things, but if every one of us just did one thing, if we cycled to work, walked to work, you know, if we just turned off all those vampiring computers, if we only drank, if we stopped this nonsensical fetish of bottled water that I'm currently indulging in and just drank tap water, it would be a great thing. Youth justice is a never-ending crusade, and it comes with lots and lots of casualties. I'm 60 years old, I know that. I've seen them, live with them and work with them. But Vince Lombardi, a great coach, said, I firmly believe that any man's finest hour, the greatest fulfillment of all that he holds dear, is that moment when he's worked his heart out in a good cause and lies exhausted on the field of battle victorious, which is just what you're doing every day of your lives. And I salute you. So to sum up and go forward, create frameworks of freedom, change the language, walk out of here as an inspirational player, not a manager or a leader, and fight on, and do it now, because you're the only people that can make a difference in this, and time is short for a lot of these kids.
It's not time to make a change, just relax, take it easy. You're still young, that's your fault. There's so much you have to know. Find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. children look at me. I am old but unhappy. I was once like you are now, and I know that it's not easy to be calm when you found something going on. But take your time, think a lot. Why, think of everything you've got, for you will still be here tomorrow, but your dreams may not.
Thank you very much. Call your dad. Call your dad. Thank you.